Hello and welcome to the Reaction Podcast. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor. I'm joined by Maggie Pagano, Executive Editor, and Ian Martin, Editor of Reaction. If you like what you hear, please do subscribe to read all our content on our website, which you can find at www.reaction.life. So this week we're going to kick off by talking about HS2. Now, we've spoken before about infrastructure and HS2 on the podcast, and Maggie, you were broadly supportive.
I was. I'd been persuaded, yes.
Yeah.
After years of sitting on the fence in some ways, but yeah, I think it is vital as part of an overall integrated transport system, and I thought that's what Boris Johnson was smart yesterday when he announced that this is not just one leg, but it is part of an overall strategy.
Yeah.
And I think people have...
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, and as he said, if you have... I mean, there are lots of caveats. We know it's too expensive, there's been a huge amount of waste, poor management, but it does seem as though they're going to pull in the reins on all of that. But if you want to connect London to the northwest and the northeast, you need this, as I wrote yesterday, Alistair, as the spine, a new spine going up to the north of England, and then you have the ribs coming across. And with this will come what was HS3, and it's now being called Northern Powerhouse Rail. That is HS3, and it will go across the Pennines. But they haven't decided, but it's to go east from Newcastle, basically across through the Midland, across to Liverpool. But it hasn't been decided. But that's an integral part of this. So I think that's important.
Ian, you've been a bit more sceptical about HS3.
Yes, I have. Yes, at various points in the Cameron years, and when things are going wrong with the economy and the Tories seem to be focused on some of the wrong stuff, it became a bit of a sort of standard trope, I suppose, which was don't waste time on all of this, and this is a waste of money, and spend a smaller sum on improving transport, but in the north. But I think it's. I can't get outraged by the decision as some people are, or seeing it through the prism of being disappointed with Johnson. I think it's almost impossible to envisage a situation in which he wins the general election on the platform that he did, and using the rhetoric that he did about rebalancing the country and levelling up the country, and then as one of his first major acts in office, then say that 10, 11 years after the thing was announced that he was scrapping it. It wasn't going to happen. I think behind the scenes they investigated ways in which they might they might curtail it or dramatically reduce the cost, but they were, it's now easy to say with the benefit of hindsight, after it's been announced, they were always going to do this. And he now really has to own it. It's part of his strategy of, as I said, levelling up and investment, and on it goes.
I think in some ways too that the controversy helps him to really pin down the various phases and the cost savings. So, this Britain is not big enough really to need a fast high-speed train. That was the sort of first mistake. We just don't need 350 miles an hour or whatever. So maybe, I don't know if it's too late to do that, because you have to have a straight line and you have to have more concrete to support the line when it's such high speed. Maybe they can adapt that. And they're certainly looking at stage two, which is the why going up to Manchester via Crewe and Leeds, whether they need to be such high speed. So that it might well be that they can make savings.
But then it's the thing further north won't be completed until 2040. The concept of Scotland seems to have been completely disappeared from the plan. That was I'm not wrong, am I?
I think Manchester then goes up, and then some people would argue actually that's where they should have started, because they're talking once it's done you take an hour off the time to Glasgow.
But it's London, but Glasgow. That is, but it doesn't get to Manchester until 2040. Is that right?
Yes.
I think these. Yeah.
And Alistair, you said you wrote in the Reaction Daily Mail that by then you'll be having a midlife crisis or something. Like to think what age I'll be by the time I can go on this railway.
Well, yeah, I'll be 44, so the first of probably a series of crippling.
And it will probably cost £500 or something. I think that's something they will have to be very careful.
I mean, it's one of those things.
Structure.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those. I mean, it's one of those things where you kind of say, unless they do invent teleportation, you do need to upgrade.
Yes, I know. I think people's comments that this is, you know, last century's technology for the 21st century is sort of nonsense. Rail has, you know, existed and done very well for the last couple of hundred years. It's still the best way of transporting people around,
so in that,
unless we have telekinesis or whatever.
So in that light, what was the point of the Downing Street spokesperson talking about, well, the launching of this inquiry into a bridge between Scotland and Northern Ireland? Was that serious, or was it a kind of feint before the HS2 decision?
You mean
came
that
out?
they floated something, literally in the Irish Sea, something so insane that then it made HS2 look rational?
Yes, a feint. You know, in the
that's possible. Yeah. It's possible. But
fencing sense.
Yes, it's possible. Yeah. But
why isn't it England to Ireland? By the way, why isn't that the better one?
Or Wales. Well,
yes, Wales to Ireland.
It's a very long way.
Not as far as. Is that further?
No, it's further. It's further.
Is that further?
Yeah. For anyone listening, if you've got access to Google Maps,
you can check
this now, because we haven't. I think it's difficult with this administration because it is so dysfunctional in an interesting way because of the Cummings business. Yeah. It's quite difficult to know precisely where these stories come from and which ones are genuine and which ones are floated to try and detract, switch attention. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it, you made the point, Alistair, earlier in the week, that when it was floated, it was mentioned as being going from the Mull of Kintyre, Campbelltown, which, and that's true. I thought you were joking, and we had to then check for the Daily Email. But it's the plan too is to go to the Kintyre Peninsula, which is, unfortunately, it's a 3.5-hour drive from Glasgow, and then as one of our readers, Declan Ganley, pointed out, you know, who lives in Galway, he said, as he put it brilliantly, he's forever waking up in Galway thinking, I wish there was a way to drive to Mull of Kintyre.
Yeah, it's just 10 hours to London.
Exactly. Once you're in Campbelltown, you know it's only a 10.5-hour journey. So I don't quite see how that works. Unless, are they planning a motorway in the air between Campbelltown and Glasgow, or but the other proposal is more sensible.
Yep.
On one level, geographically, it goes a bit further south, which goes essentially across to it opens up that route, which at the moment is the ferry at Stranraer, then going across to various Irish ports and to Northern Ireland, that you then open up, and I can see the argument for this. Mm. You then open up a corridor which is between Ireland and Northern Ireland and Scotland and the northeast of England and the motorway network. So in agriculture and manufacturing terms, maybe there's something there. But it's a £20 billion project, which would probably end up costing a lot more than that. And I mean, I have mixed feelings about it. It's clearly insane, but other countries do attempt projects on this scale.
Well, Sweden and Denmark have got, I mean, slightly different because there is so much trade. I just wonder about where's the demand factor in this?
Well, we're talking about Riviera and in Dumfries and Galloway, so you can see that there'll be enormous demand for beach holidays in the summer.
It is beautiful there, if you know that part of the world. It is beautiful there, but it is deserted.
Right, and that's why it's so beautiful. Leave it that way.
I can't imagine that there'd be much general traffic through there. There are, because of the ferry service, there is of course freight, and there's agriculture and there's stuff that's produced in the north and in the Republic of Ireland. So it's not that there's no trade at all, but it doesn't seem it doesn't seem as though there's the scope to increase it exponentially and make spending 20 billion quid on a bridge that might fall over.
It is true, in the era of Gaeldom, in the before the modern period, there was a quite vibrant all west of Scotland, Ireland economy.
That was the route.
Yeah, with mostly cattle trade, I think, and that was basically how all the clans supported themselves.
Well, also they ideas.
Went by boat.
Yeah,
I mean, exactly.
Yes, yeah. It was everything. It was by boat, and then if you look at the Lairds of the Isles, it was also, remember, connecting with routes that were bringing all sorts of stuff, pottery, etc., up from or cloth up from what is modern Spain or from southern France. So it's quite a sophisticated, you know, small volumes, but quite a sophisticated trading route ran up through Ireland and then across the west of Scotland. Because,
and is that how the Vikings came down too?
Well,
would they have gone from Scotland round down
round
to it, Ireland?
Yes, but sort of round the top. But the historian Neil Oliver, his book on history of Scotland, which is very good, short history, is particularly good on that because it begins, it begins way back with the sort of geological formation of Scotland and Ireland. But it's very strong on explaining how we... Because of the road network and modern transport and modern life, we tend to forget that these economies were, until a couple of hundred years ago, were primarily seagoing seagoing economies. So if you go to somewhere like Colonsay and Horonsay, the two islands which we got stuck on last year, that was, you would have seen 600-700 years ago, if you looked out to sea, that would have been constant traffic between the two. But so maybe that's what Boris has got in mind.
Yeah, and that's what, incidentally, given you're talking about Neil Oliver, what made the BBC's Coast programme kind of mesmerising, because
incredible.
It was about rediscovering these,
maritime
things that we definitely have forgotten.
Yeah.
We're going to gesture slightly towards a reshuffle that set to take place at some point.
Well, because we've talked about it before, and it's happening this week. Mm. So by the time some people are listening to this, you'll know
that we got it completely wrong.
Exactly. So we're not going to get it completely wrong by predicting it. It may have happened by then. It's quite different from most other reshuffles that I've covered or paid attention to, in that this one has been signalled like no other, been pre-briefed like no other. So it's been coming for a long time, and members of the cabinet are quite depressed, I think, just like on death row, waiting to find out whether they're for execution or not. So it has held up. That, combined with the power of Dominic Cummings and the particularly strange way that things are being run in Whitehall at the moment, means that people are just waiting to see and are worried, but they'll know soon enough. I think for some of them, the sack will come as a blessed relief, the way that things are so strange in government at the moment.
Yeah.
But we'll also know what sort of government this is going to be, whether it's been briefed as being a massive, bold reshuffle where the entire machinery of government is recast. And that's what Cummings wanted, and if it doesn't happen, then you know that he's lost that battle. But then, does Boris keep Cummings, or in a diminished role, or does Cummings still think that he's really running government? And there are lots of cabinet ministers who Cummings wants fired, but Boris doesn't like conflict. So we'll know fairly soon. I have to say, so far Boris has been quite establishment in his instincts about how.
Well, he,
these
as
decisions
you said,
are made.
He likes to be liked, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's not somebody who is comfortable with having the knives stuck into him. But what would be interesting is, what do we think would be good to be shaken up? I mean, the point is always made that there are 33 people, members that attend cabinet.
Yeah, there's,
that does sound top heavy to
there's
me.
Cabinet plus attending, yes. Mm. But the chief whip will be telling him that it's great in theory to talk about tearing up the cabinet, but even though he has a majority of 80, he has to be careful about who he makes as an enemy, because even with a majority of 80, there are a host of issues on the Brexit talks, through prosecutions of service personnel in relation to Northern Ireland and the Troubles. That could attract a big rebellion, and as we've said before on this podcast, you don't even need to lose a vote, you just need to slash a majority from 80 to 5 to put the government under a lot of pressure. So he has to be careful. If it would be a bold thing to do, for example, to put Jacob Rees-Mogg on the back benches and make him chair of the ERG again, but we'll see. Mm. But to your question, Maggie, I mean, I don't think it would be. It's obviously not going to be the Chancellor who's fired. I think that would be a mistake. You've got to give him a go at presenting a budget and seeing what he can do. And Foreign Secretary is a bit of a question mark. He has trusted Raab and is close to Raab. Priti Patel, I get the strong impression Boris is terrified of Priti, but we'll see.
That doesn't surprise me.
There's another reshuffle rumour that's now gone 360 degrees. I've heard everything from Home Office to be completely abolished to Home Office to be saved, for bits of it to be hived off to justice, for a new immigration department.
Border control.
Well, the reality with this is that this is all in Boris's head.
Mm.
Yeah.
Or if it's not all in Boris's head yet, it's been built up and built up to this point where this week, by the time some of you are listening to this, he has to actually decide.
How long does Cummings last in his role as sort of spinning top? Chief spinning top, going off.
Well, if you take the case of Steve Hilton, and Cummings is not directly comparable to Steve Hilton. Steve Hilton, people will remember, was David Cameron's guru, Sven Gali figure, also scruffily dressed, was like to be photographed going through the front door of number 10. Now, Hilton lasted for, I think I'm right in saying, about 2.5 years, certainly 2 years. But he was never... Cameron was always the senior partner in that relationship, and Cameron never allowed Steve Hilton to be in charge of government or to be above all of the advisers and above all the ministers. So it was a different relationship, whereas Cummings has come into government having had a promise from Boris, quotes, "I need to be in charge of everything.
And I'm going to shake things up."
Yeah. So Boris was slightly desperate, remember, when he wanted Cummings to come and help him try and sort out Brexit and get it done and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But he should have said, well, actually, no, you can't be in charge of everything. That's the Prime Minister's job, but you'll have a key role. But Boris, in his jolly way, said, yeah, great, 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 come on board. Yep, fantastic. And Cummings did. So Cummings is doing what he said he would do, which is trying to be disruptive and trying to really shake up the government. It could last, in his case, it could last a month.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I saw that footage of him talking about kids' TV this week
on
his doorstep.
Mm.
Yeah, I thought that's got to be the end game, but maybe it isn't.
Mm.
Maybe.
But for him, how long? I mean, part of me doesn't like speculating constantly about Dominic Cummings because the Commentariat loves doing it,
and he loves it.
Yeah, but how long for him personally can he survive repeatedly being knocked back? I mean, over the last month and a half, almost everything that he signalled in the past that he wanted to happen has gone against him. It's HS2, getting a NASA-style, whatever it is, nodule in the heart of government.
Yeah.
And it's these increasingly wild briefing in the papers about
He won the battle on DARPA, the research.
Oh, right, okay.
The research model. So he's not... You're right, he has lost most of the big battles that he's fought.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was his pressure that actually helped Boris to say go ahead with HS2, but put all those caveats in, you know, ministerial oversight, stopping the taking HS2 Limited away from Euston Station. I mean, maybe the disruptor has been
possibly
there.
Yeah.
You know, helped Boris to be tougher. I don't think he's going anywhere this time. You know, what's the expression? Not going anywhere fast.
Yeah.
But I think Boris needs him. He needs a disruptor beside him. Because he can.
I think there is a role for that in classic business terms. It's great to have a strategy director or something whose job is to think those thoughts. In the 90s, they'd have called it something naff like blue sky thinking.
Yeah.
And if you have the hierarchy properly structured, that person, one in every 10 ideas will be taken up, and there's something of real value, and the rest can be by a strong chief executive or a prime minister in this case, can be just quietly you just quietly say no thanks. So you get the disruption and the energy and the radical thinking, but the way that the British system works, you can't have someone like that at the top of the structure.
No.
Thatcher didn't do that. Thatcher relied to an extent which a lot of her admirers now just refuse to acknowledge. She relied on the permanent civil service.
She was her own disruptor.
Well, she was, but also look at the people who she was closest to, who helped her deliver latterly Charles Pole. Bernard Ingham had been a journalist but was then a full-time civil servant, and Robert Armstrong. So she had she could be disruptive, but she had a sense you have to make the machine work for you. Whereas there's plenty of stuff online. I wrote about it at the weekend for subscribers, and I recommend the video, which is look up Dominic Cummings' The Hollow Men, which is about an hour and a quarter, a lecture he gave, where there is good stuff in it, but it also just essentially castigates senior civil servants as idiots. I mean,
you don't get anywhere in life by telling anyone they're an idiot to you.
There is that.
Tell not show.
There is that. So I don't. I think he's been sold something by Boris that you can be in charge, which he equates to being in charge of the country or in charge of the government machine, which is what he's always wanted. Something which is not sustainable longer term, and I think the civil service have got his number, but we'll see. It's addictive and seductive to be in that position, so he might just take the view that actually he will still, as you said, Maggie, he'll win some of those battles and he'll have an influence, and if it doesn't work out as Boris goes in a more establishment direction, in 6 months' time Boris might turn to him and say, come on, I need you to do your thing again. So maybe he just won't give up. Another of his one of his friends said to me, well, he can go off to Stanford and write a book on disruption. And
is that the sort of thing he'd want to do, though? Seems to be much more of an active.
I don't know.
No. Well, to quote The Hollow Men, not with a bang but with a whimper.
One of my favourite, second favourite after The Wasteland Poem. I think we need to talk, gentlemen, about tax. Because in the last
There's
far too much of it. But in the last 4 to 5 days, you would almost think that Corbyn had actually won the election. We've had the Treasury leaking stories that, one, they want to introduce a mansion tax. Two, they want to abolish entrepreneurs' relief. Three, they've done nothing to change IR 35, which I know most people make their eyes glaze over. Terribly important for thousands and thousands of freelancers. And there's another one, I think I counted up 5 different. Oh, and pension relief, of course. Now, this is not what you'd expect.
That's taxing. That would be taxing it on the way in and on the way out.
And reducing by how much. Now, these are not the acts of a conservative government, one would not have thought. So my question is, have they all gone native? Which is what happens so often, particularly in the Treasury, and just desperate to find, you know, 2 billion here and 2 billion there, because it's not actually much. Entrepreneurs relief would only save 2 billion. Or are they trying to be too clever by half, which is to show to the sort of softy centre lefty people that they got to vote Tory this time that actually we did mean that we're a fairer whatever, and are they playing to that gallery, or have they, or a third option,
or
is that they're incompetent,
or
it's more lefty think tank world,
or lefty think tank world. IPPR came up with the entrepreneurship.
Or there's another option.
There is,
and this is all ahead of the budget. And we know, don't we, that there's been warfare between Team Cummings and the
Javid.
Chancellor,
yeah.
that relationship has broken down, but Javid has successfully defended himself to the fury of Cummings and deals direct with the Prime Minister. That seems to be the situation. That was the situation as of a week ago, unless there's been some great outbreak of peace. I just don't know about all those stories because they are, I mean, sorry to be vague again, or that's my point earlier about, is this is such a difficult administration to read at this stage. I thought a lot of those stories were really convenient. If you were fighting a war against the Treasury, someone, I can't think who, if you were someone in number 10 wanting to make the Treasury look as un-Tory and as obstructive as possible, then it's not inconceivable that a bunch of stories about tax rises and the stuff that you mentioned somehow magically finds its way into the newspapers. I'd just put that thought out there.
So he is.
It's just a bit. I don't know. It's all a bit. The stories just struck me as a bit too.
They're weird.
Convenient. They're weird stories, and if you read the one brief to the. To the Sunday Telegraph.
Mm, that was the pensions relief story, wasn't
it? Yeah, and then which is then monstered by the Sunday Telegraph editorial. You know, Boris, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
And are you, you know, is this a Tory administration or not? I just pose the question. It just all seems very convenient, or is it a slightly, is it the Treasury playing a game quite deliberately, where it's turning up for these meetings with Number 10, which are very difficult, and saying, well, this is great, you've gone around the country, you've spent all this, you've promised all this money, you want to do 20 billion here, you want to do 5 billion for buses, you want to do, you want to, at some point, you want to, you want to spend lots more on the NHS, there are changes coming on migration which are going to put up employer costs and have potentially have distorting effects on the economy. This is all terrific, you've got all the stuff you want to do, but it all costs money in one way or another. How do you want it? How do you want to find that money?
Yeah.
To which the mood that Number 10's in, you say, well, don't be so destructively negative and defeatist, and Britain's going to boom and it's all marvellous. But if you're the Treasury and senior officials, you're conditioned to take a different view, which say, great, but where do you want on this menu of options on tax changes, which ones do you like and which ones do you hate? So are those then being plucked out and then briefed as this is what the Treasury wants to do? Don't know.
That's very fascinating. So swiftly on to international affairs. We're going to speak briefly about the Irish election. Ian, what were your thoughts on the
I feel, having read quite a lot of Irish commentators and people like Fintan O'Toole writing about Britain in the last couple of years, and having read his stuff very closely, I feel tempted to break my usual rule of not getting too much into the politics of a neighbour, and it's I think it's extremely sad what's happening to Ireland. I just find it extraordinary that. I understand the reasons why it's happened—a housing crisis, a rejection of the two mainstream parties. I understand all of that is maybe a bit similar to what happened in Britain in 2017 with Corbyn, but still, that's the reality. Is almost a quarter of Irish voters voted for a party which is, and there's no way around it, which is the political wing of the IRA.
Yeah, within living memory of the troubles.
Maggie, you were there, I think, at
Bishopsgate, which was in 1994?
1990, I think.
1990, I was at the Sunday Telegraph at the time, Saturday morning working in 4th Street, and we heard the bomb go and the glass panes of glass virtually shattered, they were sort of echoing, and I ran out onto the street down to Bishopsgate and saw the smoke, police out on horseback. And then, I'm going to tell the whole story, and then ran off to Cheapside and phoned the copy desk at Sunday Telegraph and filed a story. It was horrendous. I mean, it was there. Yeah. And then we lived with all the metal blockades throughout the city, didn't we, for months and years. It's so visible. We forget it too easily.
I mean, also, it's really sad to see commentators who have disgraced themselves over the last few years on the left, like Owen Jones, immediately responding by saying, look at Sinn Féin's success. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. Look, this is a mod, you know, this is shows that the Labour Party is going in the right direction. You're just like, can you resist for one moment,
yeah,
as a commentator, for repeatedly looking to international models for success. Before it was Venezuela, now it's Sinn Féin. Before, yeah, also it was Podemos and Syriza in the Mediterranean. I mean, it shows a basic lack of imagination, really.
There is a... I certainly don't want to get into it. Isn't the British system great? It's hardly covered itself in glory in the last couple of years. But one thing that the election in December did show, that one of the advantages of the British system is that it can produce a really quite swift response to a populist outbreak or a political meltdown and deliver a decisive result. Mm. So essentially the Tories got the fright of their lives, had to respond, had to change leader. It's not clear to me in Ireland that either of the two main parties are going to respond in the way that they should do. They should obviously concede that they've completely screwed up on housing, mm-hmm, and that the Irish Health Service needs urgent attention, and they've been, both parties have clearly been complacent. But neither of them seems to be planning to put in place a charismatic new leader and then try, mm-hmm, and then try and make an entirely new offer and win a majority, because that's not how the system works.
Instead, well, neither of them even seem to be discussing it, do they?
No, instead it is instantly what the PR system does to you, and it's the classic sort of approach to European politics, is it forces you to say, well, I know we said last week that we would never countenance them in government, but actually that's this week, and you just look at the numbers, so we have to accommodate our thinking to it, rather than what happened in Britain, where you had close to a political meltdown, destruction of trust in the system, and then something quite
robust
and decisive and interesting
within
a year.
And a really interesting conversation took place, which
yes,
we're now talking about.
Yes.
That is to do with principle and ideology and thinking. Whereas,
But then I suppose the reality is 75% of Irish voters did not vote for Sinn Féin, but we'll see. So we'll draw a veil over it there, will we, and move on to another country's politics. Should we talk a bit about the US?
Yeah.
Because I'm getting really into this race, having thought that I wouldn't, because it just, the failure of the Democrats to find someone who can take on Trump was kind of depressing. If you like American history and you like the American conception of democracy, it seems to have a habit of producing the right people at the right time for emergency moments. And you look at the Democrat lineup and it's pretty grim. However, if you look at what happened in New Hampshire, and Ivo Dorney, who's there for writing for Reaction, and really interesting piece which chimed with something which I've just been starting to think in the last 48 hours, is that Bloomberg's going to do it.
Mm.
Now, there'll be people listening to this, and I remember an argument with a friend just a few months ago who knows America very well, saying you have to get this into your head. It is never going to happen. He's never going to win the nomination. He's never going to win the presidency.
Because? Why not?
Because he doesn't... There's no way in which he will play in the kind of...
Too rich,
he's not going to win
too gilded.
A billionaire like that is never going to win in Ohio, or it's not even going to win. It wouldn't stand up in a chance in Florida, for example. Now, but that said, with the same force with which people said Trump would never win. So I just started to think that the way that the race is playing out, it seems apparent that if Sanders is the front runner, which he is, Mayor Pete is the moderate, but seems too insubstantial to stop him or to become the figure. Warren is fading away, and presumably quite a lot of her voters will transfer to Sanders, which then creates the question, who's going to stop Sanders? Mm. And Bloomberg is then very well positioned, spending hundreds of millions of dollars in the key the delegate heavy seats, which are about to come round now it might not fall for him, and it may be that the Democrats are an impossible party to unite because the Democrat far left or hard left is now so entrenched and would never back a Bloomberg. But you can start to see for the first time how it might happen, and that's, I think, actually really quite innovating and exciting.
And on top of that, Bernie's performances in Iowa and New Hampshire have had question marks over both of them. I mean, last time he did way better in New Hampshire against Hillary than he's done this time. And in the, I mean, Iowa, we know how much of a fuck up that was.
Yeah.
So, but I don't quite know how the contest is structured. But what I've seen of Bloomberg is that he's going very aggressively on veterans issues in the early all his campaign ads, or a significant proportion of them, are going on about how Trump has let down veterans. He's also better, as far as I can see, at putting the line that Sanders uses about Trump's personality, where Bernie says he's a liar and a crook, but Bloomberg kind of sticks. It's a bit more focused, and it's more like he's out of control, and he's a threat to national security.
It's just lovely the way in which the best quote of the election race so far, when he was asked this week or last week, do you think the American voters really want a presidential race in which is fought between two billionaires? And he said, who's the other one? which is a good joke, which contains quite a lot of truth in it as well, and dodges one of his main weaknesses, which that is going to be his problem if he does get the nomination, is that the left will find it very difficult to rally behind him, and might even run some sort of strange third candidate, and voters in some of those seats that Trump is good at reaching, if the economy is doing okay, if the economy is still doing quite well and it hasn't been knocked over by coronavirus or something, if the economy is doing well, then is the Bloomberg message on competence and civility really going to make a difference or not?
It'd be quite funny if America oscillated between Trump, who looks so has this grotesque look around him and seems so out of step with the presidents of the last 100 years, and Bloomberg, who literally looks like a sort of throwback to Eisenhower or Harry Truman or someone.
It's really making me want to get over there as soon as possible again. I was there a lot in 2016, and so I really want to go and see it again. It's also, everyone thinks that Boris is friends with Trump, which I suppose he is, to the extent that leaders can ever really genuinely be friends, but there is a connection there. But Bloomberg was mayor of New York at the same time as Boris was mayor of London. I remember a friend giving me an account of Bloomberg going to visit Boris and not really having ever encountered anything quite like it, because when they got to the office, Boris had just taken delivery of some new Boris bikes and wanted to show this off to Bloomberg, saying, you should do this in New York, and proceeded to get on the bike in the office and cycle round and round his desk. Apparently Bloomberg just said nothing.
Just looked askance.
But they did know each other, and there was a bit of a connection there, a connection between their teams. Bloomberg's also reassembled all of that team, or most of that team, from his mayoralty, which is very, very high end. And as Ivo pointed out is in his piece for Reaction, he'd hired a friend of Ivo's, and after he'd been there for a few days, asked if he had enough money, would he like some more? So he's just spending hundreds and hundreds of millions and seems determined to do it. But my point is that 3 or 4 weeks ago, this seemed like a bit of a joke, and maybe now it's going to happen.
He could be the sort of Tony Blair of Labour Party, couldn't he? That would be the sort of role, in the same way that Blair was the only one that could get rid of Clause 4. I mean, it's
possibly
like De Gaulle getting rid of being able to hand on Algeria. It has to be
somebody who's
inside, so the Democrat who understands and comes from a background of money, but then can talk to the left and say, yes, there is a lot wrong with the capitalist system and we're reforming it. He sort of has an authenticity.
But then he's also, but that's true, but he does have, he has weaknesses looking at the American electorate with on gun control, for example, on quite sort of nanny, well, he's very nanny statish on and bossy on sugar and taxation. So that'll be a problem. Trump will present him as the guy who's always trying to boss you around and thinks he knows best from New York, and not on the side of the ordinary guy. So I'm not saying if he gets a nomination he definitely wins, but I just think you could start to see how it happens. But I think if we're going to wrap things up there, just point out that if you're not a subscriber to Reaction, go to the website www.reaction.life and become a subscriber just before the price goes up, and tune in to the Reaction podcast next week. Thank you for listening.